Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I bring what I feel is the cutting edge understandings of where we're heading as a collective race and what the future of humanity looks like. And starting off the show, I have two very interesting guests. First, we'll be talking to Steve Bassett of the Paradigm Research Group, who's very much involved in government disclosure of UFO secrecy and cover-up. And then I'll be talking to Nick Redfern, who wrote the book Contactees, about the history of alien-human interactions. So, Steve, why don't you give us a little rundown of where we are now, I mean, where we are in the world situation. We wanted Obama to disclose the government secrets in this first year of being president. It hasn't happened. Where are you now?
All right, disclosure didn't happen in 2009. I think the economic collapse was the principal reason.
Yeah.
It didn't help, that's for sure. Plus the two wars, which continue. The Democrats have had a terrible year, and they've made a number of mistakes, and one of them was not disclosing. If they'd have done that, I think it would have had a huge impact on. But it's not their call. Ultimately, it's the call of the military intelligence management group that runs this show, the UFO issue, and they decided obviously not to move forward yet. But still, I think they're happy to do it with Obama and do it under his administration. So that didn't happen. But we had a very powerful year with a lot of events affecting disclosure. The Catholic Church continued to take a strong position. Gabriel Funes, their head astronomer, confirmed Corrado Baducci's remarks about the church being comfortable with the idea of ETs. They then held an astrobiology symposium in November. Russian Navy announced it was releasing its underwater classified documents regarding some pretty amazing cases. China announced that it was going to be studying film from the UFO scene during the eclipse. The UK continued to release documents. Denmark started releasing documents. Uruguay. We had, with the other major events, several others. The Gary McKinnon case drew a lot of attention last year, huge amount of press in the UK. We've had quite a bit of coverage on this issue in the United States as well.
What was that case about?
The Gary McKinnon case, the computer intruder who they've been trying to extradite for 5 years because he went looking for UFOs and NASA computers and a couple of others. It's a public relations fiasco for the United States. And if he's extradited, it will be even worse public relations problem for them because it's going to generate a huge amount of UFO media, related media, in the U.S. and generate a lot of media time for some of the researchers and activists.
So what can we do to support
this?
Well, what can we do to support the cause of government disclosure and coming out with this to help your organization?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? I'm sorry, Alan, could you repeat that question?
I said, what can some of us listening do to help support you and the whole cause for government disclosure?
In my case, the answer to that is complicated. In my case, it's fairly easy. I mean, the disclosure movement is now international. Exopolitics World Network has got 23 countries. There are many groups, many people pursuing various things, space treaties, the UN, and of course other countries are being pressured a little bit. But in my case, it's straightforward. Paradigm Research Group is putting its primary resources behind the factsonwashington.org. Since November 5, we've been raining faxes, letters, and emails toward the White House, toward the President-elect's transition headquarters, and since June the 1st, toward the White House press corps. Factsonwashington.org is the website, and these letters are now going to the White House Correspondents Association, demanding that the press corps start asking the political questions regarding Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and John Podesta and Lee Antonetta and Bill Richardson and the whole Rockefeller Initiative, and responding to Edgar Mitchell's call for the truth embargo to end. These are very legitimate questions. We've got them pretty much pinned down. There's nowhere for them to go. They won't even at this point acknowledge they're getting this correspondence. So we can just continue to pound them with this. And when you go to factsonwashington.org, you can see a list of the kinds of questions we want asked. You can see the address, fax, email. and mailing address for the White House Correspondents Association. So we're really focusing there. And so the best thing that someone can do for PRG's work is to go to factsinwashington.org, get off a letter, fax, and an email, just a couple of paragraphs, make your point, send all three off because they can't keep track, and keep the pressure on. I just sent out an international press release to 5,000 radio stations, television stations, and newspapers to re-energize the Facts in Washington, and booked about 35 media interviews, with probably another 15 more be added onto that. Mm-hmm. So that it's back in play. It's funny, but we're getting a little help. Apparently, Grant Cameron has indicated that more documents are about to be released, UFO-related documents, based on his FOI request from the Clinton Library. Mm-hmm. A researcher was able to, named Antonio Cousin, I believe his name is, was finally, after 2 years, able to determine that the book in Hillary Clinton's arms, when she met with Rockefeller at his ranch, along with her husband, he's walking along, we have a lot of photos of that. We found out the book that she was carrying as she was walking along with Lawrence Rockefeller turns out to be the book called Are We Alone? Philosophical Implications of Extraterrestrial Contact by Paul Davies, who mm-hmm. recently attended not only the Vatican Astrobiology Symposium, but he is about to attend the symposium at the Royal Society on extraterrestrial life. So the scientific world is lining up on the issue. The Vatican Church is lining up on the issue. Countries are releasing their documents by the thousands and tens of thousands, putting pressure on the U.S. More witnesses are coming forward. So the pressure on the embargo is greater than ever, and it's hanging by a thread. And that's why it's important to really put the pressure on right now and break this open before something grotesque happens, a nuclear event, a new war, something awful. Let's get this done. So we really have everything lined up. The administration of Obama will either do this or another nation will. Russia and China both, I think, made statements in 2009 that they're in the game here and that they can't be ignored. And they would gain enormously from such an event, the truth embargo ending, say, by Russia or by China. Huge implications for the United States. So that's kind of where we are. And the last thing I'll mention is the X conference is about to be rebooked for 2010. About to sign the contracts.
What's the date?
We paid the Hilton Hotel off from last year, and by the time of the conference, we will have all the speakers paid. It will be May 7, 8, 9, and 10. Including the press conference. And the whole conference is going to be held at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Two blocks from the White House, eight blocks from the Capitol, and 10 blocks from all of the major political news organizations. So it's the first time any conference of this genre has been held at the press conference. There have been press conferences. At the National Press Club.
Let me ask Nick if he has a question for you. Hey, Nick, do you have anything you want to ask Steve?
Yeah, I guess, you know, one question that's always sort of, or one issue that's always sort of interested me, Steve, is, you know, do you have, like, feedback from people on the inside that are sort of very sympathetic to getting it out there, that, you know, as frustrated as, you know, I guess some of us on the outside, you know, yourself doing all the hard work, do you feel that you're actually getting help up from the inside as well?
We have no way of really knowing that. Yeah. They simply do not broadcast what their thinking is or what's going on. We hear rumors. Odd things turn up from time to time. Gordon Novell was on Coast to Coast AM with George Knapp last Sunday night, and he's brandishing Ron Pandolfi's name all over the place and talking about how the CIA is trying to bring this technology forward, that there's a battle going on. He's dropping a lot of names, not sure what's going on there. Other rumors have been turning up, and, of course, the UN may have gotten involved about 18 months ago by holding some meetings. That was leaked out, possibly by a Navy officer. There is a lot happening, but not surprisingly, there's no way, barring, you know, I mean, if I was Robert Woodford and, Woodward and I had maybe $500,000 in Washington Post money behind me, maybe I could run some of these things down. But none of us are in that position. Mm-hmm. So we see these rumors. We watch the Internet traffic. And the sense you get is that something is definitely going on. There's something going on underneath the surface. When you couple that with what we do know is happening in the public arena, particularly with other nations' actions, we are clearly at a place we've never been before in terms of disclosure being a possibility. I feel good about that. But again, the government is not going to give us a peek at what they're thinking or talking. I don't expect any leaks, or if there is a leak, it'll be quickly inoculated against. They're not going to do that, because if they do, they will literally be hounded to disclosure with a screaming pack of media on their back. You know, I mean, they'll just be driven to it, and that's going to make the government look bad. So that's not something they would like to have happen. I don't care. I mean, we'll continue to hit the media hard, and the facts in Washington will press the White House press corps with the message that the facts in Washington is sending is twofold. One, it's sending the message to the press corps, it's time for you to do your job. Stand up and do your damn job. But it's also sending a message to the government, look, you know, don't wait for the press to finally break this open. Don't wait for them to go nuts on this. Get it done. Do it in an orderly fashion. Come out so that you look good. Don't be driven to disclosure by the press coming after you. There's a two-pronged message there in the facts in Washington.
Well, thank you, Steve. Again, ParadigmResearchGroup.org, FactsOnWashington.org, and x-conference.com is the websites that can reach you. And you're our connection to the government. You're the guy, Steve.
Connection to the disclosure movement. There may be some better inside connection people than me to the government. I'm more of an outside guy. But I want your listeners to know the information for the X conference will be up soon. And given where it's being held, there is a much better chance that members of the White House staff may come attend, members of the congressional staff may attend, and members of the media, the political media, could be at that conference this time, better than ever. And we need to send them a strong message. When they come to the press club that weekend, they need to walk in there and see a ballroom completely filled with people attending this event and listening to these speakers. We need to fill that place up. So I'm encouraging people, support this issue. Come to the press club. Be there for this conference in May. Let's send the strongest possible message to the leaders and to the press that we're serious about this.
Well, definitely I support that, and we'll do more shows before the May conference. Okay, Steve?
I appreciate that. Thank you. Nick, it's nice to talk to you, my man. I'll be in touch.
You too, Steve. See you later.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks. So Nick, that's interesting to hear Steve say, you know, wow, it's closer than ever. But, you know, reading the material and looking through your book, it always seemed like, you know, the UFOs, the ETs were going to make their appearance any day. Isn't that right, you know? It always seems like
I think
close.
There's several ways of looking at things. You know, I think the problem with the whole issue of UFO secrecy is that the government, to a large extent, those that are in the know, you know, don't want to tell us. And I think Steve's doing the right sort of thing by taking an alternative approach of actually, you know, putting pressure on and lobbying people and getting the word out to say, hey, you know, let's sort of really, you know, push the envelope further and try and force disclosure. So I think in that respect, you know, it's a good thing, because unfortunately these alien entities, whatever they are, they don't seem to be interested, right now at least, and at any point throughout history, in actually landing and, you know, in simple terms, saving the rainforest, curing cancer, giving us, you know, endless technologies and saving the polar ice caps. It seems that whatever their agenda is, it's very much shadowy, behind the scenes. It involves interaction with us, but it seems, you know, radically altering our society for what we perceive to be the better hasn't happened yet. So, and the government doesn't want to tell us. So that puts the UFO research community in a very much of a difficult position as to how we actually get the answers. So, you know, I think the only way is to, like a full-pronged attack, we try and get the answers through the UFO subject, through the Freedom of Information Act, through the sort of stuff that Steve's doing with disclosure. And hopefully, you know, this whole unified attack, if you like, almost, we'll get the answers, you know, because if we sit around doing nothing, we definitely won't get the answers. So.
But maybe the whole phenomena is not supposed to be conscious. I mean, supposed to be, I mean, it's like perhaps it's always slightly below the radar because of some bigger picture that we might not have an idea about. Have you thought about that in your research?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of people get into the UFO subject and they take a very black and white approach that, well, aliens are visiting the Earth, the government's hiding the truth, and that's it, you know, and we're the good guys trying to get the truth out. You know, in a simplistic fashion, that scenario is very valid. But on the other hand, you know, there could be lots of other factors coming into play, some initiated by the government, others initiated by whatever this alien intelligence is. And by that I mean, you know, the whole idea of non-interference with inferior, less technologically advanced races. You know, we've all seen what has happened, for example, with the Australian Aborigines, you know, when the British went over there and with the Australian settlers, and the Aborigine culture was pretty much sidelined and destroyed almost. You know, you get that sort of situation happen when superior cultures, I won't necessarily say invade, but go into another area, and the lesser culture is absorbed, and it's often absorbed for the worse. So that could be a reason why we don't have a direct interaction with whatever these creatures are. On the other hand, you know, although a lot of people like to look at the whole UFO presence in a friendly aspect, there could be a sinister reason behind their presence here, and that sinister reason could be what prevents them from wanting to meet with us openly, because who knows what sort of agenda they have for us. So, you know, I think we need to look past the black and white of aliens exist and we're the good guys trying to get the information out of the bad guys, i.e. the government, and look at the big picture of the implications that are present also within the UFO subject.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a lot of research in this field. I've seen UFOs. I may have been an abductee myself. So what I feel is that they aren't necessarily sinister, but their level of consciousness is so beyond anything we can comprehend that actually to be in their presence is traumatic. It's overwhelming. It's life-changing in a sense. And
yeah, so, I agree with you on that. Yeah, I mean, I've never personally had that sort of life-changing UFO experience. But what I would say is if there are beings out there that are, you know, thousands of years, so to speak, in front of us, then the chances of us actually being able to have a one-to-one interaction, a conversation with them, are probably pretty slim. You know, it's like if you go back 200 years, just 200 years, you'd be very hard-pressed to try and explain to someone what a television is or an iPod or the internet or a car.
Exactly.
You know, they probably would grasp what a car is because, you know, that's not too different from like a steam engine. But, you know, the internet or a computer or a television would be radically difficult to explain. And we're only talking about 2 centuries. Trying to have a conversation with a being or a race a million years in front of us would be
impossible. Exactly my point. So I don't think,
yeah.
It's impossible for us to understand at our level what they might be up to.
Yeah, it's not like Star Trek or something where, you know, the aliens come aboard the Enterprise and chat in English and everything's cool, you know.
But you know what's interesting about the book and the cases you talk, like in the 50s, Adamski, George Van Tassel, there seemed to sort of be a lightness, a sort of fun aspect of the aliens. And then in the 60s, especially with the Barney and Betty Hill case, the aliens turned a bit sinister, a little dark. I mean, is that true, that transition?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
that's definitely true. I mean, you know, you look at the whole abduction subject today, although some people come away from it positive, in a positive fashion, a lot of people are actually very traumatized by the abduction experience. You know, the idea of being treated like a lab rat in a medical experiment, you know, leaves a lot of people with nightmares, post-traumatic stress disorder, things like that. Back in the 50s, you're quite right, it was sort of, with the contactees, they claimed interaction and personal meetings with very human-looking aliens, often with heads of long blonde hair, and who would talk about, you know, the perils of nuclear war and things like that. So it was very much more of like a one-to-one spiritual, cultural exchange. And although certainly contactee experiences still go on to this day, you know, they've certainly been eclipsed by the more darker, bleaker abductions. Now, we could argue that that's a deliberate ruse or project or motivation on the part of the aliens to present us with different scenarios to see how we react, and then they can gauge what we're like as a species and a society, how our mind works. You know, do we, you know, are we fearful of the abductions but more inclined to deal with friendly aliens? That might motivate the way in which they deal with us in the future. You know, it could be like a psychological experiment, like a good cop, bad cop scenario, something like that.
But it's true, that could be, I hadn't thought of that, but it seemed like almost a different aliens. If you look at the way Adamski and Van Tassel interact with those beings, they're totally different creatures from the little greys, and maybe they were different creatures.
Yeah. Well, I think there's two possibilities, Alan. One is that we are literally dealing with different types of entity. You know, in abductions, the so-called greys, as they become known, famously known even, the little guys with the big heads, the black eyes, etc., they're radically different to what the contactees said they met in the 50s, which were very human-like beings, sort of 6 foot to 6 foot five tall, heads of long blonde hair. A few subtle differences, such as in the size of the eyes or the distances between the eyes, etc., things like that, where you would kind of look at them twice but still view them as human. One of the things I do wonder is if the alien intelligence has the ability to manipulate the human mind to actually allow us to see it in the form that it wants us to see it in. And, you know, the idea that in the 50s, when they made perhaps their first tentative approaches, the idea of presenting themselves in a human-looking form would be more acceptable and comfortable to us. Maybe that was some sort of like a brain-created image, and the greys are their real form. And, you know, it was an idea of not to freak us out by presenting themselves as initially as these weird bug-eyed little creatures. You know, maybe something like mind control, mind manipulation came into play in some respect.
Well, I definitely think the aliens can manipulate our mind. I think a lot of what we're talking about is how the human beings relate to something that is non-human. Actually, yeah. I just wrote an article for my website called The Aliens of 2009, where I took the three big motion pictures that came out this year, Avatar, of course, and then there was District 9. Did you see that movie?
Yes, I did, yeah.
And then there was the movie The Fourth Kind.
Yeah.
And in all those three films, there were three common themes, which was the humans seem inferior, right?
Right, yeah.
Another theme in there was that, that we are sort of becoming them. Like each of those films, there was a part of a merging of a human and alien embodiment.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really interesting. I thought that suggested a kind of subconscious integration of alien human as a preparation. Does that make sense to you? So our subconscious mind through cinema is starting to open up to the idea of a greater integration.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think that's an important factor, is that my personal view on the UFO presence is that for a large part its means, its motivation is to, I guess, radically alter the mindsets of human beings. You know, the idea of coming around to their way of thinking or changing our mindset. And, of course, I think governments can be quite fearful of the idea that the population isn't just going to sit at home and watch reality TV and go to work and come home and go to bed, etc., that we might actually respond to this phenomenon in a way where, you know, we take on, like, alternative lifestyles that are sort of driven by the phenomenon, and we become sort of self-aware entities, not just, you know, living for the slave state, so to speak. And I think there's good evidence that a lot of people have been radically changed in a positive fashion by UFO experiences. And if that happened on a worldwide basis, and we basically, in simple terms, gave the finger to the government, you know, and, right. and just went about our own way, following new teachings, that would be very kind of threatening to them. And I think that's one of the reasons why there's so much secrecy. It's the effect, the potential effect that the subject can have on the population that makes the government frightened. You know, they don't want people rising up and asking questions.
It's the same situation as Copernicus and Galileo had with the church. They didn't want people rising up. So we're in the same situation. They were ultimately proven to be right. And I think, obviously, for anyone who's looked into the subject, there have been visitors on whatever level people might think. They're here. But I do want to go back to the 50s a little bit and talk about someone like George Adamski, who's not even mentioned in, let's say, the mainstream, whatever mainstream is, but people like Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs, they don't even, like, credit Adamski with any legitimate experiences at all. But what do you think of someone like Adamski? Because you've researched it. And give a little background about him.
Yeah, sure. Well, George Adamski was originally born in Poland, moved to the U.S. with his family when he was just a small child. And in the 1930s, he set up an organization out in California called the Royal Order of Tibet, which was sort of like a very much a spiritual alternative commune-type organization, which, you know, back in the 30s was sort of pretty radical. You know, today it's not something people would look twice at. But back then, you know, going into some sort of alternative spiritual lifestyle outside of the confines of society was a little bit different. So he was someone who was almost primed for, I guess, an alternative life and unusual experiences. And what happened was that in the late 1940s, he claimed a number of sightings of UFOs in the skies over California. Then in the early 50s, said that he actually had personal interaction with an alien being out in the California desert, where he said on one particular occasion he felt compelled to go out to one specific place. This sort of classic 1950s flying saucer type craft came down, and there was an interaction and a discussion by telepathy on the subject of the perils of atomic warfare and how the Cold War might mutate into a Third World War. And again, it was sort of much, very much a message of, you know, passing on and imparting wisdom and getting Adamski to, so I guess, spread the cosmic word. Now, you know, Adamski was just one of literally hundreds of contactees who said, you know, they'd had these experiences with human-like aliens who wanted them to go out there and, I guess, sort of, you know, preach to the unconverted, if you like. Other people, such as George Van Tassel, you know, organized conferences out in the desert and got audiences in literally in figures of like 12,000 at a conference, which is unheard of today.
Well, that's, you know, it. People don't realize how big the movements were.
Yeah. Well, that's the important thing. Yeah, that's a very important thing. People think, you know, it was just a couple of people lecturing to, you know, half a dozen people and some guy's dog or whatever, you know. In reality, George Adamski's first book in its first printing, Flying Saucers Have Landed, sold 125,000 copies. As I said, George Van Tassel was regularly getting audiences in excess of 10,000 people at his conferences. And I think even though a lot of researchers today deny any credibility to the contactee issue, the fact of the matter is it became not just an interest for a few people. It literally did mutate into a huge movement that attracted thousands and thousands of people. And I think that's one of the reasons why we know today that the FBI watched a lot of the contactees, purely because it was viewed, I think, very much like a protest movement of the 60s. You know, it was people galvanized to get up and say, hey, you know, let's change things.
I mean, Adamski claimed to have been taken aboard. I mean, these were friendly aliens. I mean, what do you think, though, of Adamski? I mean,
Okay, I think, like a lot of the contactees, I think Adamski had some genuine experiences. I think, as I mentioned earlier, I'm pretty sure that some of the contactees were sort of rendered into altered states of mind by these aliens, and that some of their experiences that sound very outrageous, but they earnestly related, could have been almost like brain-borne imagery and holograms created by the aliens as a form of having contact and trying to get a message across. In other words, you know, they may have been rendered into almost like a Matrix-style state where they didn't physically, you know, be taken around the solar system on spacecraft, which, of course, is a highly controversial scenario at the best of times, but actually may have been that thought or that idea via sophisticated mind manipulation may have been instilled in them. I think there's a lot to that potential idea, and I think that relates to Adamski and others, that they earnestly believed what they were saying, and they got a message across, but how much of it was, you know, literally physical, or how much was like, as I said, a brain-borne manipulation by these entities, I think is sort of a gray area, no pun intended.
So you feel Adamski had a legitimate experience, and yet so many modern contemporary researchers discount it. I wonder why, because it seems like it's the same thing over and over again. Adamski's experiences don't fit into the model that's now being presented, so it's been discounted. It seems like they're perpetuating the very thing that they're trying to come up against.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I would stress is that personally, I don't think George Adamski flew around Venus and Mars with aliens. I don't think that. But I do think this intelligence manipulated his mind and other people's minds to make them graphically believe that some sort of altered state and like a Matrix-style hologram was actually happening to them. Now, when you talk about today, you know, if you speak to a lot of abductees, they will tell you they were taken on board a craft, and not only were they subjected to medical experimentation, but sometimes, you know, the aliens would kind of press like a, almost like a wand, like a magic wand almost, to their head, and they'd see images of, you know, the collapse of the rainforests or the polar ice caps, like, you know, ecological destruction. That's actually no different, really, to the Space Brothers spreading messages in the 50s about nuclear destruction. What we're basically getting is messages from higher entities warning us about the nature and the future of the human race if we don't mend our ways. So I always find it kind of unusual that there's this sort of barrier between people who research contactees and people who research abductees, when other than the fact that one is 6 foot tall with blonde hair and one's 3 foot tall with no hair, the message, you know, the message isn't that different, really.
Right. So that's interesting. You see it as a continuum, not as a break between the 50s contactees.
But I do sometimes wonder, as I said, if it's actually one race of aliens playing good cop, bad cop, and actually manipulating us to see them in different forms and, you know, render us into altered states to believe we've had certain interactions that may be the mind being manipulated, actually.
I mean, I think actually contact will be a couple of hundred years in the making until they are accepted as, you know, as a regular type of experience, you know. Probably the first time people saw airplanes in the sky, everyone stared at them, but now you don't even look. I think it's the same thing with UFOs and eventually ETs, but it's a slow integration. That's what I feel, and I think they're actually here to evolve us, and we might be, according to the research I've done, evolving them genetically somehow. They seem to be here for our genetics.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's probably several things going on. I don't think it's just as simple as, you know, a lot of people think that aliens are coming here, they've crashed a few times and the government's hiding the secrets. I think it goes far deeper than that and far more significant in terms of, you know, the implications for us individually, but as societies around the world. And again, I think no government wants us to sort of be thinking along those lines. And, you know, even the economic issues, you know, what if they were to introduce to us overnight new technologies which rendered the need for oil completely obsolete, and it bankrupted the Middle East overnight because we said, sorry, we don't need your oil anymore. You know, that could make an area of the world that's already highly volatile even worse if we bankrupted each of these nations. You know, what if somebody came up with a cure for cancer and suddenly the entire hospital system goes out of business because nobody needs medical care anymore. You know, it sounds crazy, but all these things could come into play where society is radically transformed to where it might be difficult for the for our societies today to grasp and cope with such massive changes all of a sudden.
So that's what it seems like. They're trying to shield us from a radical transformation, and maybe the government is actually working at odds with the aliens, but in somehow conjunction to make this transition smoother?
Well, you know, I think for the government, it's sort of like a difficult scenario. I think on the one hand, whatever the technology is, they want to know how it works, and each government wants to be the person who understands the technology first because they obviously want to try and capitalize on it from a military perspective. But on the other hand, I think they realize that going into it too deeply threatens the cover-up, and they want the cover-up to remain in place because they want the status quo to remain in place. They want the population to be the underlings and them to be the leaders and us to not complain about things and, you know, they tell us what to do, etc. So I think it's, you know, for them it's a difficult scenario. I don't have much sympathy for them, but I do think for them it's a difficult scenario as to how they handle it. My personal view is that they should have, in the early stages, said, okay, you know, something's going on, something's coming here, people are being abducted, you know, contacts are going on. We know it's some sort of otherworldly intelligence. We're not really sure what they want or why they're here, but we're telling you because the more we hide it, the more trouble it's going to cause as time goes on. You know, that's what happens. People keep secrets and they get bigger and bigger until it all comes tumbling out. So.
Right. No, definitely. And there is slowly an opening. I was in England in the crop circles, and I definitely think most of them do not seem to be made on the ground by human beings. And we're opening up. I mean, it's going to take a while before mainstream gets there, but I think we're on the road to getting rid of those lies. But tell me a little bit about how you got into all this. I know you've written other books, Strange Secrets, and what else? Memoirs of a Monster Hunter. Well, tell me about your background a little bit and how what opened you up. Like, you know, we all pretty much brought up mainstream and been fed a certain ideas about how the world was. What was it that opened you up to the idea that the world wasn't how you were told it was?
Well, you know, I said I've never sort of had like a life-changing personal UFO experience, but how I got interested in UFOs is that my dad was in the British Royal Air Force and he worked on radar. And he was actually involved in several incidents where UFOs were tracked on the radar scopes. This was in September 1952, flying over the east coast of England and the English North Sea. And nobody knew what these things were. Aircraft were sent up to try and intercept them. Pilots couldn't get close. And this actually went on for several nights where these UFOs would come back time and again, almost as if, you know, testing our defenses. And everybody was told not to talk about it and, you know, mindful of the government's secrecy acts, etc. My dad didn't tell me this till the late 1970s. You know, I was just a kid then. And, you know, it sort of really got my interest, not just because, hey, the government knows something, but because, you know, it was also my dad, and he was trained in radar. So, you know, you had people in the military talking about these things. And when I finished school, I began working on a music magazine in England and enjoyed, you know, journalism and things like that, and thought, well, why don't I try and get more into, like, investigative journalism? Excuse me. But from the perspective of looking into UFOs. So that's, you know, that's what I did and the reason I dug into it. So, and I mean, even to this day, you know, my dad still talks about it. He, you know, to his credit, he doesn't claim to know all the answers beyond that these people were trained experts in radar and none of them had a clue, you know, what these things were at all.
So did that shook up your father's worldview a bit? I mean, was he changed by that experience somehow?
Well, I wouldn't say he was changed, but what I would say is that he had a deep awareness that there's a genuine UFO mystery. Now, you know, I think if you have a personal interaction like an abduction or a contact experience, that is going to radically alter you. I think from my dad's perspective, it was more along the lines of, wow, you know, UFOs exist, something's going on. But, yeah. You know, he wasn't overwhelmed by it. It was more like a bit of a sort of a jaw-dropping revelation that he then just incorporated into his life to where today, you know, he's very interested still in the subject even now. You know, he's nearly 80 now and 77. You know, and he's still very interested and takes a keen interest if there's anything on TV. So, in other words, you know, this experience that occurred back in the 50s is still with him to this day. And I think that's an important aspect of many people's experiences. It doesn't leave them. That's how profound the subject is to them.
Well, that's true. So what other strange secrets are you interested in?
Obviously a lot to do with UFOs. I'm pretty interested in, you know, the whole history of crashed UFO stories, contactees. I'm very interested in cryptozoology. That's my other big interest, which is the hunt for unknown animals like Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster. That's one of the other areas I write a lot about. And, that's sort of a little bit alternative where, you know, can perhaps elevate our minds a little bit.
But do you think there is a case for Bigfoot to exist?
Well, yeah, I do. I think like UFOs, you know, a lot of cases can be explained, occasional misidentifications, etc. But at the end of the day, I think there's a small core percentage of reports that are strongly indicative of a you know, some sort of unknown creature. What it is, you know, whether it's an unknown ape, an ape man, you know, or something weirder. We just don't know. But I'm like the UFO subject, I'm convinced that there's something going on.
So, like, if you read the old Charles Fort books, he talks about these things have been going on for at least, you know, 100 or so years. And it seems like nothing has really changed. I mean, it's surprising. Yeah.
You're right in that respect. Things have changed in terms of, if you look at the UFO subject, that's kind of radically changed. You know, in the 1890s, we had the Phantom Airships. Second World War, we had the Foo Fighters, flying saucers in the 50s and 60s. And today, we have a lot of these black flying triangles, and the long-haired aliens have been transformed into the greys. So the subject phenomenon has sort of mutated throughout the years. But you're quite right, in terms of us as researchers getting answers, unfortunately, we're still, to a large extent, scrambling around in the dark, which is unfortunate. And, you know, you see so many people who got into the subject in their 20s, say, in the early 50s. Now, you know, they're passing on as they reach their 80s, and they didn't have the answers. And it kind of makes me wonder now, you know, am I going to be 80 and still wondering what's going on with the UFO subject?
Exactly. It's kind of makes you think there's nothing that our conscious, it's not meant for our conscious awareness somehow.
Yeah, I sometimes wonder if there's like a deliberate reason why they don't want to approach us and they don't want to give us the answers. I think sometimes it's like forcing us to look for the answers. And even if we don't have the literal proof, if we come up with answers that alter our lives for the better, maybe that's what the purpose of it is to try and teach us, but not lecture us. You know, it's to let us find the answers and to our own satisfaction. And maybe if we do that, as I said, even without having hard evidence, maybe sometimes, you know, that's enough if you come to a firm conclusion yourself based on your own evaluation of what's going on.
I mean, I do think things are going to change. I think 2012 could be a really big, I mean, that's my feeling about 2012. I know everyone's talking about it, that I think there'll be maybe then a public announcement or acknowledgement that, guess what, we have been visited. What do you get about 2012?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, I mean, you look at, for example, a number of books and certainly the movie 2012, you know, you see it's portrayed as very much like an apocalyptic scenario. You know, the end of the world, volcanoes, tidal waves, earthquakes, you know, the sky falling in. if you actually go back to the original Mayan legends, what you find is that they're not so much talking about the end of the world. It's more like the end of an era and the passing of one type of civilization, society, or lifestyle to another. You know, it's like if you go back a couple of thousand years, you know, there's no longer a Roman Empire, but people still live in Rome. There's no longer an Egyptian Empire, but people still live in Egypt. And I think it'll be like that, that maybe today's society will be pushed aside in favor of something else. And perhaps that'll be due to disclosure. But I don't think it'll be the end of the human race, or, you know, I don't think New York or Los Angeles or London's going to fall to the ground. I think it'll just be a radical change, possibly in the mindset of the population, to where the old ways have gone and a new society rises up, if you like.
No, I totally agree. And it does seem like we are evolving into a new society. When I interviewed Bruce Lipton, do you know his work?
Yes, I do, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, in my interview, you can actually see it on YouTube. He says we go from the one to the many to the one. So as countries come together to form a one planet where we're all connected, then we're in a state of unity that can allow us to speak to other planets as a singularity. So I think that is where we're heading collectively. So I do think at some point in our near or far history, disclosure or contact, whatever you want to call it, aliens will be among us. And
oh, yeah, I think there's definitely going to be developments.
It's just a natural evolution, just a natural part of our of a cycle that's taken a long time. Look how long it's taken us to kind of get over dogmatic religions that have, you know, brainwashed people. I mean,
I don't mind what religion anybody has or doesn't have. You know, I think it's like anything. When it becomes something that's force-fed, then it's problematic because, you know, it smacks of manipulation and people being told what to do rather than coming up with an answer and a conclusion for themselves.
So what are you working on now? I mean, this book has been very successful.
Yeah.
You've been on all the great radio shows besides this Coast to Coast. I heard you on that show. But what are you working on at this point?
Well, I can give you sort of a little bit of a scoop. I'm working on a book that will hopefully be published in about 4 months' time. And what it deals with is a think tank type organization that at least existed in the U.S. government from the 70s till definitely the 90s. I haven't been able to verify that it does today, but it was sort of like a very deeply buried think tank group that looked at the UFO issue. And this think tank, bear in mind this is just their views, but they concluded that the UFO presence was like a deception, like a satanic, demonic deception. They viewed it from like a very religious perspective. So I'm writing a book that talks about how and why this group came into existence and how and why they interpret the UFO mystery as like a, not an alien phenomenon, but like a deceptive satanic phenomenon.
What was the name of that government group?
Well, actually, the group itself was known as the Collins Elite, but it wasn't like an official thing like Project Blue Book. What it basically was a group of guys who, I guess, held official positions, but at an unofficial level, were pursuing this angle and using a degree of government funding to look into it. So it was like a quasi-official group that, you know, would meet after work and came to these various conclusions, but equally held deep influence on a lot of people within the military who came to share their views. And it's sort of a controversial story, you know, about how and why they think aliens, or what we perceive as aliens, are actually here to sort of instigate Armageddon. You know, they take a very Old Testament view of the UFO phenomenon, that it's literally a, you know, like a demonic deception. Now,
well,
the important thing I'm stressing in the book is that this isn't my story. I'm just telling their story as to what their conclusions are. So.
Were those members pretty Christian in their belief systems? Is that why they could have?
Yes, that's exactly what. That's one of the things I'm stressing in the books, that many of them actually had a sort of predisposed, extremely, deep Christian belief, and looked into it, and, you know, not unsurprisingly, maybe came to the conclusion that they came to for that very reason. You know, they had their own reasons and thoughts and ideas, and actually generated a number of very interesting files, which I'm relating in the book, which I've now got hold of, that, you know, outline their particular scenario. But, you know, as I said, the point I'm stressing is that this is their belief, and, you know, the story of the book isn't me endorsing it. It's me basically telling how the group came to existence, its history, and what its conclusions were. So.
And did those conclusions have any impact on, let's say, the secret government or the government somehow?
Well, actually, only in what, I mean, obviously, you know, they were talking about, they claimed that, you know, there were people within government that shared their views that secretly, allegedly at least, you know, concluded also that this was the truth behind the UFO subject. But in terms of the secret government, one of the things that was discussed, and now whether it was discussed beyond just a hypothetical scenario, I don't know, but the idea was to, I guess, thwart some sort of demonic invasion, was to stage like a second coming with sophisticated holograms and things like that. To get
but that's
the general
what the,
public.
ETs were going to do that, you're saying? Or
no, the government was going to use sophisticated technologies and holograms to stage a second coming to convince the general public that, you know, that religion was real, and that they felt that that would allow, if there was such a huge public belief in Christianity, far more than exists today around the world, that this would actually be able to thwart like a demonic invasion. And so, you know, it was like if Jesus didn't return, well, let's fake it. You know, let's fake a showing of the gods returning in the skies. And, you know, it's almost described to me, I almost interpreted it as like a fascist, like indoctrination of the public. That's how it kind of comes across.
It'd be a great movie. It's sort of like Wag the Dogs. Scenario.
Yeah.
Now,
of course, you know, this is just their belief system in the same way that other people believe different things about the UFO subject. I think the important thing is, though, that from the perspective of telling the story, these were people within government. That's what, to me, makes it interesting. You know, they're people with pretty high up positions of influence believing that demons were literally, you know, stealing people's souls under the guise of alien abductions and things like that. So it's very, very weird and strange story.
Wow, that's very interesting. Any known figures involved? Any names we would recognize that were involved with that?
Yeah, a few. A couple of interesting names, and you know, I don't want to say too much right now because basically what it comes down to is that I still have a few months to add material to the book, and there's a few people I'm trying to press to interview, to try and convince them to be interviewed. And, you know, I'm hopeful if I can do it in a fashion where they understand why I'm doing it, that, you know, it might make them more amenable to speaking, whereas right now they're pretty hostile to the idea. So,
very interesting.
I'll be glad to, you know, send you a copy when it comes out. So.
Yeah, no, thank you for that scoop. That's very interesting. It's a little bit somehow related to what Jacques Vallée.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite go. But what do you make of what Vallée is saying?
It's very similar to his whole, you know, the messengers of deception angle. The idea that, yes, there's a UFO presence, but it's not what it seems to be. And that's what these guys within the Pentagon and the DOD believed. And I think there is something to the idea that, you know, we don't have the full story as to why these entities are here. I think we see their craft, we see the beings, we know the government's hiding something, but the very fact that they are so stealthy and remain behind the scenes always, I think, is going to provoke this idea and notion that, well, you know, could there be more going on? Could there be less going on? But I think in many respects we're grasping at straws, and that's what specifically leads to these different theories, because it's not so black and white, and then that makes people fearful that, well, if it's not so black and white, it's got to be bad news. So I think often happens.
I take the opposite approach.
That's good, yeah.
I think the UFO, the ETs, I think if they wanted to do something, you know, pretty negative, they would have done it already. I think they're really here to help us, and we're here, and somehow to help them, because the universe, the galaxy is a collective, and we all sort of come together on some level of sentience, you know, some level of consciousness. We are connected, so...
Yeah, and I think also the one good point is that, you know, if they wanted to destroy us outright, they could have done it before we developed atomic weapons and spacecraft. You know, do it when we were just getting over the Second World War and everybody was weak and destroyed, and you know, but they didn't. You know, they let us get our strength back and build up. So that doesn't make sense if you want to destroy someone.
Exactly, and that's what I say to those people who say that the aliens are negative. No, I think they are so far beyond our level of psychological comprehension that it's as, you know, it's if your dog is looking at the computer screen and trying to figure out. That's what we're like when we're dealing with these very evolved consciousnesses. So, thank you, Nick, for the you know, for your research and your involvement in this. If people want to get in touch with you or website or something.
Yep, it's at nickredfern.com. People can email me from there. And, you know, I appreciate you having me on the show, Alan. I had a good time. I think we covered a lot of interesting areas. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, I love this stuff. This is an ongoing series for New Realities on UFOs and ET. So thank you. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. And you can check my website, newrealities.com. And this is Neil Young singing about the Silver Station.
There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen ones. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver sail.